My name never mattered in the Underhive. Down here, people recognized me as Black Hand, a moniker earned during my service in the 86th Cadian when a plasma backwash scorched my left hand to the bone. The Munitorum medics replaced the flesh with vat-grown synth skin, but it never took right, remained coal black, a permanent reminder of what the Emperor's service costs. The contract came through my usual fixer, a hunched house Orlok middleman named Jarek. I've been running security for Orlok shipments between settlements for months, but this job was different. Jarek slid the data slate across the corroded metal table in the back room of the rusted cog, a drinking hole where the ceiling leaked condensation that smelled of promethium and human waste. The payment figure made me pause mid-sip of my amasic. Triple my usual rate, with a completion bonus that could buy passage off-world if I was so inclined. The client was a guilder, one of those masked, robed figures who controlled much of the commerce flowing through Necromunda's layers. This particular guilder wanted an escort into the deepest reaches of the Underhive, past the territories claimed by the houses, into the unmapped zones bordering the toxic sump seas. According to Jarek, the guilder sought something specific, an ancient tech cache supposedly untouched since the Hive's founding. The guilder had charts and coordinates that predated current mapping systems. Jarek mentioned the client had already hired and lost two previous teams. He didn't elaborate on what lost meant, but in the Underhive, explanations were rarely necessary. I accepted the contract, not because I needed the money, though I did, but because after 15 years fighting the Emperor's wars across the stars and three more in this steel hellscape, the thought of something unknown still stirred something in me. Perhaps I'd seen too much to be properly afraid anymore. The guilder requested a 5-person team with specific skill sets. I spent the next 3 days assembling them, calling in favors and making promises I hoped I wouldn't have to keep. First came Vex, a former Escher ganger whose expertise with toxins had made her too valuable and too dangerous for her former house. She'd been excommunicated after developing a compound that killed 3 gang leaders in a territorial dispute. The Escher matriarchs claimed her work violated some unspoken code. I suspected they simply feared her knowledge. Vex brought with her an arsenal of needler weapons and toxic grenades, along with a modified respirator mask fused to her face after an accident left her lungs unable to process unfiltered Hive air. Draylock was my tech specialist, a Vansar exile whose body bore the telltale radiation burns of their house's cursed technology. His left eye had been replaced with a whirring augmetic that constantly analyzed our surroundings, and his fingers housed micro-tools that could bypass almost any security system manufactured in the last 5 centuries. He didn't speak much, most Vansar didn't, but his skills were unquestionable. Finding a suitable cadre proved challenging. Most were too fanatic to work with outsiders, but Krell was different. A redemptionist whose faith had taken a peculiar turn, he believed the Emperor's light shone brightest in the deepest dark. His body was a canvas of burn scars and crude aquila tattoos, and he carried a flamer modified to burn at temperatures that could melt ceramite. I didn't trust his sanity, but I trusted his conviction, and sometimes that was more valuable. The final addition was Thade, a Dalak information broker whose true allegiances remained a mystery. Rumors connected him to the gene-stealer cults that festered in the Hive's forgotten corners, but such accusations were common against House Dalak. What mattered was his knowledge of the deep Underhive and his network of informants who operated in places even the gangs feared to tread. Thade's eyes were hidden behind photosensitive lenses, and his pale, hairless scalp bore the interface ports common to his house's higher operatives. We gathered at the designated meeting point, a decommissioned water purification hub at the edge of Orlok territory. The guilder arrived precisely on schedule, accompanied by 2 servo skulls that hovered silently at shoulder height. The guilder's robes were finer than most, woven with circuitry patterns that occasionally pulsed with dim light. The traditional mask bore none of the usual house markings or guild affiliations, just a blank, featureless oval of burnished metal that reflected our own faces back at us. The guilder provided each of us with sealed data slates containing our route and basic objectives. The information was deliberately compartmentalized. Only the guilder possessed the complete picture. Standard procedure for those who understood the value of information in the Underhive. Our descent began through the mid-hive manufacturing zones, where the air thickened with industrial effluent and the constant percussion of machinery formed a baseline rhythm that vibrated through the deck plates. We passed through Orlok checkpoints with pre-arranged clearances, then descended further into the true underhive. The transition was never subtle. The functioning lighting systems gave way to jury-rigged lumens and burning chemical torches. The ordered passages became a warren of collapsed corridors and improvised tunnels. The population changed too, from workers with legitimate employment to the desperate scavengers and gangers who survived by whatever means necessary. We moved efficiently, avoiding the main thoroughfares where ambushes were common. Thade's knowledge proved invaluable, guiding us through service ducts and maintenance shafts that hadn't appeared on official maps for centuries. Krell's flamer discouraged the more opportunistic predators, both human and otherwise, who smelled profit in our well-equipped party. By the third day, we had passed beyond the domains of the major houses. The structures here showed signs of ancient collapse, where entire sections of the hive had given way centuries ago. Vast caverns opened up where hab blocks had once stood, their floors now toxic lakes of industrial runoff and chemical waste. The air required constant filtration, and even through my military-grade rebreather, I could taste the metallic tang of pollutants. It was here that we encountered the first Ratskin scouts. These tribal descendants of the original Necromunda settlers navigated the underhive with an instinctual knowledge that exceeded any mapping technology. They watched us from the shadows, their skin decorated with circuit pattern tattoos, and their eyes reflecting the light like nocturnal predators. Thade negotiated passage through their territory, offering medical supplies and ammunition as tribute. During the exchange, one of the older Ratskins warned us about our intended path. His low Gothic was broken, interspersed with tribal dialect, but the meaning was clear enough. People had been disappearing in the deep tunnels, not just isolated scavs, but entire armed parties. The Ratskin described shadow walkers that left nothing behind but pools of acidic residue where gangers once stood. The Gilder dismissed these warnings as superstition, but I noticed how Thade's posture stiffened. Later, away from the others, he confirmed that similar rumors had reached his information network. Three separate Dalak scouting parties had vanished in the region over the past month. House Dalak didn't share such losses publicly, but the pattern had alarmed their leadership enough to declare certain zones forbidden. We continued deeper, passing through the remnants of ancient manufacturing districts where massive machines lay half submerged in the rising sump waters. Some still functioned in limited capacity, their mechanical limbs moving in mindless patterns, producing components for products that hadn't been assembled in millennia. The sixth day brought us to the edge of what the Gilder's maps identified as our destination zone. We established a temporary base camp in the remains of what appeared to be an administrative center. The structure's upper levels had collapsed, but the reinforced lower chambers remained intact, providing defensible positions with limited access points. While Draylock established perimeter sensors, I examined the Archaeotech scattered throughout the facility. Much of it was unrecognizable, but some components resembled SDC patterns I'd encountered during compliance operations in the Guard. The presence of such technology suggested this area had once been significant, perhaps even part of the original colony ship that had become Necromunda's first hive. That night, as the others rested, I stood watch at our camp's entrance. The darkness beyond our lumens was absolute, the kind of darkness that seemed to swallow light rather than merely exist without it. The distant sounds of the hive, the groaning of stressed metal, the dripping of condensation, the occasional scuttle of vermin, created a constant ambient noise that faded into unconscious awareness. It was the sudden absence of these sounds that alerted me first. A pocket of silence expanded around our position as though something was absorbing not just light, but sound as well. The perimeter sensors remained inactive, showing no movement or heat signatures, yet the silence continued to spread. I woke the others without speaking, using the hand signals familiar to anyone who'd survived the underhive for more than a few months. Vex activated a chemlight, its green glow casting sickly shadows across the rusted walls. Draylock consulted his auspects, his augmetic eye whirring as it shifted through spectrum settings. The Gilder emerged from private quarters, the blank mask turning slowly to survey our defensive positions. For the first time, I questioned what we were truly seeking in these depths. The payment suddenly seemed too generous, the guilder's knowledge too precise. Whatever waited in the darkness beyond our camp, I suspected the guilder knew more about it than any of us had been told. Krell's flamer ignited with a soft whoosh, the pilot light casting flickering illumination that did little to penetrate the absolute darkness that had settled around us. Thade stood perfectly still, his concealed eyes fixed on something none of the rest of us could see. His hand moved slowly to a pouch at his belt, withdrawing not a weapon but a small metal disc inscribed with symbols I didn't recognize. The first attack came without warning. Later, I would struggle to describe what I saw, or rather, what I didn't see. It was as though sections of the darkness became more substantial, moving with purpose rather than simply existing. Draylock's Auspex screamed warning seconds before something struck him, his body jerking backward as though hit by tremendous force. Where the impact occurred, his armored vest began to dissolve, the material sloughing away to reveal skin that bubbled and smoked. What followed was chaos. Vex deployed toxin grenades that filled the chamber with bioluminescent particles, briefly illuminating shapes that defied comprehension, forms that seemed to fold into themselves, appendages that moved in impossible ways. Krell's flamer roared, streams of promethium igniting patches of the darkness that burned with an unnatural purple flame before extinguishing themselves. The guilder remained motionless throughout the attack, the blank mask reflecting the chaotic light of our desperate defense. It was only when one of the shadow forms moved directly toward the guilder that I witnessed something truly inexplicable. The guilder raised a gloved hand, revealing an object that pulsed with internal light. The shadows recoiled from it, creating a perimeter of emptiness around the guilder that nothing breached. I fired my lasgun until the power pack depleted, each shot illuminating fragments of our attackers without seeming to harm them. Thade had disappeared entirely. Vex collapsed next to me, her respirator mask partially dissolved, revealing flesh beneath that slewed away like wax under a flame. The next moments exist in my memory as disconnected images. Krell's flamer exploding as something breached its promethium tanks, the guilder walking calmly through the chaos toward a previously hidden doorway, Draylock's augmetic eye continuing to record even after the rest of his body had been reduced to a steaming puddle of organic matter. I ran. There is no valor in that admission, no strategic withdrawal or tactical repositioning. Pure animal instinct took control, and I fled through tunnels I barely remembered, pursued by sounds that no human throat could produce. My night vision implant malfunctioned, alternating between blinding brightness and total darkness. The tunnels twisted in ways that contradicted the maps we'd studied, as though the geography itself was shifting around me. Hours or days later, time had lost meaning. I emerged into a section of the Underhive I recognized. My equipment was gone, my armor partially dissolved, and my skin burned where something had brushed against me during my escape. Of my team, there was no sign. Of the guilder, nothing remained but the memory of that blank mask reflecting our deaths back at us. I made my way back to inhabited zones, back to the relative safety of House Orlok territory. The payment had been deposited as promised, enough to leave Necromunda forever. But wealth means little when sleep brings visions of shadow forms and the sensation of being watched by something that exists between the spaces of reality. Now I sit in the rusted cog, writing this account while waiting for transport off-world. The shadows in the corner seem deeper than they should be. The sounds of the bar occasionally fade into that same unnatural silence I experienced in the deep Underhive. And sometimes, when I catch my reflection in the tarnished metal walls, I swear the face looking back is not my own, but a featureless oval of burnished metal. The journey downward resumed at dawn, or what passed for dawn in the timeless depths of Necromunda. Our lumens cut weak paths through the perpetual gloom as we followed the guilder deeper into territories I'd only heard described in the fearful whispers of Underhive scavengers. The familiar stench of human habitation, the mixture of recycled air, waste, and unwashed bodies, gradually gave way to something older and more primal. The air took on a mineral quality, carrying traces of chemicals I couldn't identify despite my rebreather's filtration system. By the second day of our descent, we encountered the first signs that something was wrong. An Orlok checkpoint lay abandoned, its fortified position still intact but utterly devoid of personnel. Weapons remained in their firing positions. Half-consumed ration packs sat on makeshift tables. The scene resembled the aftermath of a void ship's emergency decompression, as though everyone had simply vanished in an instant. Thade moved through the abandoned outpost with practiced efficiency, his gloved fingers examining items without disturbing their positions. His assessment confirmed what we all suspected: the Orlocks hadn't left willingly. The lack of blood or signs of combat made their absence more disturbing, not less. Three levels deeper, we discovered what had become of them, or at least what remained. The bodies lay scattered across a junction where three massive tunnels converged. Lazburn scarred the walls in chaotic patterns, evidence of frantic, undisciplined fire. Stub gun casings littered the ground by the hundreds, their brass gleaming dully in our lumens. The corpses themselves defied explanation. Each had been partially dissolved, as though submerged in powerful acid, yet the surrounding environment showed no signs of chemical exposure. Flesh, bone, and equipment had melted together in grotesque amalgamations that bore little resemblance to human beings. Vex collected samples while maintaining a professional detachment I found admirable. Her analysis, delivered in clipped technical terms, suggested the dissolution process was biological rather than chemical, enzymatic in nature, similar to digestive fluids but far more aggressive and targeted. The implications hung unspoken in the stale air between us. The Gilder observed our examination without comment, the featureless mask revealing nothing of the thoughts behind it. Only when Vex had completed her analysis did the Gilder motion us onward, deeper into the unmapped territories. We passed through three more abandoned defensive positions that day, each telling the same story of sudden disappearance followed by violent last stands. Gang markings changed as we descended. Orlok gave way to Goliath, then to Cawdor, and finally to territorial markers I didn't recognize. The pattern remained consistent. Those who fled survived longer than those who stood their ground, but none had escaped completely. The eighth day brought us to a massive breach in the Hive's ancient walls. The opening yawned before us, easily 20 meters across, its edges smooth and curved as though the metal and rockcrete had been liquefied and pulled outward. Beyond the breach lay a network of tunnels unlike any I'd encountered in my years on Necromunda. These passages weren't constructed, they were grown. The walls possessed an organic quality, their surfaces reminiscent of ossified tissue rather than manufactured materials. Ridges and channels ran along the curved surfaces in patterns that suggested deliberate design, yet no human architect would conceive of such formations. The tunnels predated the Hive's construction by millennia, perhaps tens of millennia. Draylock's instruments confirmed what my instincts already whispered. These tunnels weren't imperial in origin. They weren't even human. The composition analysis revealed biological compounds fused with minerals in configurations that defied standard categorization. The passages had been secreted rather than built, like the hardened tunnels of colossal insects, but on an incomprehensible scale. The Gilder's demeanor changed upon entering these ancient passages. The measured pace quickened, the blank mask turning frequently to consult a device concealed within voluminous robes. For the first time since our journey began, I sensed urgency, perhaps even anticipation, from our employer. That night, as we established a temporary camp in a chamber where several tunnels intersected, the Gilder finally revealed the true purpose of our expedition. The blank mask remained expressionless as the Gilder activated a hololithic projector that displayed images of excavation sites and fragmentary text in a script I didn't recognize. The Gilder's explanation unfolded methodically. Our objective wasn't merely to recover Archaeotech or standard SDC fragments. We sought a data slate containing records from a pre-imperial archaeological expedition, one that had discovered something beneath Necromunda's surface before the first Hive foundations were laid. According to the Gilder's information, that ancient team had unearthed evidence of non-human civilization and technology that predated mankind's arrival on Necromunda by eons. The data slate supposedly contained coordinates and access protocols for a repository of knowledge from the Dark Age of Technology, information preserved by those first explorers and then lost during the tumultuous early years of the Hive's construction. The Gilder emphasized the value of such a find, technological understanding that could elevate a person to the highest echelons of Necromunda's hierarchy, perhaps even draw the attention of off-world powers. What the Guilder didn't explain, but what became increasingly obvious, was why two previous expeditions had failed to return. Something else dwelled in these ancient tunnels, something that had been disturbed by human incursion after lying dormant for untold millennia. The next day brought us to an abandoned dome settlement, one of the self-contained habitats established during Necromunda's early colonization. The dome's structural integrity had somehow remained intact despite the surrounding hive sections having collapsed centuries ago. Inside, we found a perfectly preserved snapshot of Necromunda's distant past, habitation units, hydroponic facilities, and atmospheric processors designed for surface conditions rather than hive integration. The settlement showed no signs of violence or hasty evacuation. Its inhabitants had simply left, taking little with them, as though responding to an orderly relocation order. The undisturbed nature of the site made it ideal for establishing our base camp. The ancient power systems even responded to Dreylock's efforts, providing limited illumination and environmental control. We deployed in standard underhive defensive formation. Krell established firing positions covering each entrance, his flamer positioned to create choke points if necessary. Vex placed toxin dispensers at strategic intervals, designed to incapacitate any human intruders and slow larger threats. Dreylock installed motion sensors and Auspex scanners salvaged from our journey, their machine spirits coaxed into cooperation through his esoteric Vansar rituals. The first anomalies appeared on the sensors within hours of activation. Movement registered at the periphery of our detection grid, but in patterns that defied logical explanation. The contacts appeared simultaneously in multiple locations, disappeared completely, then reappeared in impossible positions. Dreylock's analysis suggested the contacts were moving through solid surfaces, passing through walls, floors, and ceilings as though they were insubstantial. The Guilder observed the sensor readings with that same impassive mask, yet I detected a subtle tension in the robed figure's posture. This wasn't surprise, it was confirmation. Whatever stalked us through these ancient passages was known to our employer, at least by reputation, if not direct experience. As our first night in the dome settlement progressed, the sensor anomalies increased in frequency and proximity. Thade positioned himself near the main entrance, his customized auto pistol loaded with specialized ammunition he hadn't felt the need to use until now. The pale Dalak removed his photo lenses briefly to scan the darkness with his natural eyes, a rare occurrence that underscored the gravity of our situation. Whatever he saw or sensed caused him to apply a greenish unguent to his eyelids before replacing the lenses. Vex's behavior changed as well. Her methodical preparation of toxins took on a frantic quality I hadn't witnessed before. She combined chemicals in sequences that violated standard protocols, creating compounds that steamed and pulsed with bioluminescent properties. When I questioned her methods, she simply indicated her respirator and shook her head. These formulations were too dangerous to discuss, even in the filtered air of her mask. Krell's religious fervor intensified with each passing hour. The Redemptionist inscribed prayers and wards on his flamer's promethium tanks, his scarred fingers tracing imperial aquilas with ritualistic precision. His mumblings grew more animated as he worked, though I couldn't make out the specific words. The flickering light of the flamer's pilot flame cast his shadow in distorted proportions against the dome's curved walls. Dreylock maintained his composure better than the others, but even his augmetic eye showed signs of strain, its scanning patterns becoming increasingly erratic as it struggled to process the contradictory sensor data. The Vansar technician made minute adjustments to his equipment, each modification more desperate than the last, as though trying to force reality to conform to comprehensible parameters. My own unease manifested in constant weapon checks and perimeter sweeps. 15 years in the guard had instilled habits that surfaced in moments of extreme stress. I field-stripped and reassembled my lasgun repeatedly, confirming power levels and sight alignments that hadn't changed since my last check. The familiar rituals provided little comfort as the Auspex continued to register movement that shouldn't, couldn't exist. As the artificial night cycle deepened, the dome's ancient lumens dimmed to conservation levels, creating pools of shadow between islands of weak illumination. The darkness beyond our perimeter seemed to deepen, not merely as an absence of light, but as a presence in itself. The constant background noise of the hive, the distant machinery, the settling of massive structures, the echo of human activity faded to silence, leaving only the sound of our breathing and the occasional click of Draylock's augmetics. The first direct contact came 3 hours into the night cycle. A sensor at the outermost perimeter registered a temperature drop of 30 degrees in 2 seconds, followed by complete failure of the unit. The failure cascaded through the sensor network in a pattern that moved directly toward our position. Not randomly, not exploring, hunting. Vex deployed her specialized toxin grenades in a defensive perimeter, the compounds releasing clouds of particulates that hung in the air like luminous fog. The particles revealed disturbances in the air currents that corresponded with the sensor failures, shapes that moved without conforming to humanoid or known Xeno's anatomies. The forms seemed to fold into themselves, extending protrusions that withdrew and reappeared in configurations that violated physical laws. The dome's ancient systems reacted to the intrusion. Emergency protocols activated without Draylock's input, sealing bulkheads and initiating atmospheric purge sequences designed to eliminate contaminants. The automated response suggested these defense systems had encountered similar threats in the distant past and recognized them as existential dangers. The Guilder retreated to the central command dais, removing a device from within those voluminous robes. The object resembled a navigational tool of archaic design, its surfaces inscribed with symbols similar to those displayed in the earlier hololithic projection. The device emitted a soft pulse of energy that rippled through the dome, causing the advancing shadow forms to hesitate momentarily. That brief pause gave us the opportunity to fall back to secondary positions, abandoning equipment and supplies in favor of defensible terrain. The shadow forms resumed their advance within seconds, moving with greater purpose toward the central dais, where the Guilder worked to align the mysterious device with markings on the dome's floor that had previously gone unnoticed. The patterns beneath the accumulated dust of millennia formed a complex geometric configuration that mirrored the tunnels we had traversed to reach this place. The dome settlement wasn't merely a colonial outpost, it was built as a nexus point, a deliberate interface between human construction and the ancient non-human architecture that predated it. As the Guilder completed the alignment, a section of flooring reconfigured itself, panels sliding away to reveal a descending spiral pathway that hadn't appeared on any of our scans. The passage led downward, deeper than our instruments could penetrate, into darkness that swallowed our lumen beams without reflection. The shadow forms reacted immediately to the opening, their movements becoming more agitated and purposeful. They converged on our position from multiple angles, no longer concerned with stealth or indirect approach. Whatever the Guilder had activated had provoked them into direct aggression. The next moments would determine whether any of us would survive to discover what lay at the bottom of that ancient spiral, and whether the knowledge it contained was worth the price we were already beginning to pay. Sleep came in fitful bursts that night, my mind refusing to fully surrender to unconsciousness. The ancient dome settlement's environmental systems cycled with irregular rhythms, producing sounds like labored breathing. By what passed for morning in the perpetual darkness, I'd managed perhaps 3 hours of fragmented rest, plagued by half-formed nightmares of dissolving flesh and impossible geometries. The Guilder assembled us with purposeful gestures, indicating that we would proceed deeper through the spiral passage discovered the previous night. Our objective lay ahead, the repository of knowledge that had cost 2 teams their lives already. Thade examined the spiral entrance with obvious reluctance, his gloved fingers tracing symbols carved into the surrounding stonework with an expertise that suggested familiarity with such markings. Draylock was tasked with establishing a Vox relay at the entrance to maintain communication as we descended. The Vansar technician methodically unpacked specialized equipment from his carbon fiber case, components that bore House Vansar's distinctive blue-white energy signatures, but incorporated modifications I'd never seen before. The tech specialist worked with practiced efficiency, his augmetic eye whirring as it analyzed optimal placement points. While Draylock configured the relay, the rest of us prepared for descent. Vex distributed filtration inserts for our rebreathers, specialized compounds designed to neutralize airborne toxins and spore-based contaminants. Krell checked his flamer's fuel reserves with ritualistic care, muttering what sounded like passages from obscure Imperial texts. Thade maintained his distance from the group, constantly scanning our surroundings as though expecting attack from any direction. I performed my own equipment check, verifying my lasgun's power pack and ensuring my combat knife was secured but accessible. The weight of my flak armor felt reassuring against the growing sense of wrongness that permeated the ancient structure. 15 years in the guard had taught me to recognize the feeling that preceded ambushes and void ship boardings, the instinctive awareness of impending violence that no training could fully explain. With preparations complete, we gathered at the spiral entrance. Only Draylock remained behind, making final adjustments to the Vox relay. The Guilder gestured for us to proceed, remaining at the rear of our formation as we began our descent into the unknown. The spiral pathway curved downward at a gentle angle, its surfaces composed of the same ossified material as the tunnels we'd traversed earlier. The walls bore intricate patterns that shifted subtly under our lumen beams, creating the unsettling impression that the structure itself was alive and observing our passage. Our footsteps produced no echoes despite the enclosed space. The material seemed to absorb sound rather than reflect it. 20 minutes into our descent, the Vox unit at my belt emitted a burst of static. Draylock's transmission came through fragmented and distorted, his normally precise technical language reduced to disjointed phrases about signal degradation and unexpected interference. I attempted to establish clear communication, but the connection deteriorated further with each passing moment. The final transmission consisted only of a high-pitched mechanical whine followed by what might have been a scream, though the distortion made it impossible to determine if the sound was human or technological in origin. After that, only static remained. The Guilder made no comment about the lost communication, merely gesturing for us to continue downward. Thade's posture stiffened, his hand moving to rest on his auto pistol's grip. Vex and Krell exchanged glances, their expressions hidden behind their respective masks, but their body language conveying shared concern. I signaled a halt to the group, explaining that we needed to verify Draylock's status before proceeding further. The Guilder's blank mask turned toward me, the featureless surface reflecting our lumen beams in a way that momentarily created the illusion of expression, something that might have been disapproval or impatience. After a moment of silent consideration, the Guilder acquiesced with a slight nod. Thade and I retraced our steps up the spiral while Vex and Krell remained with the Guilder. The ascent seemed steeper and longer than the descent had been, as though the passage itself had somehow stretched during our journey. When we finally reached the entrance, we found only emptiness where Draylock should have been. Vox relay remained, its components arranged in perfect technical order, power indicators still glowing with steady blue light. Draylock's tools lay precisely positioned beside the equipment, as though he had stepped away momentarily and expected to return. His weapon, a modified Las Carbine of Van Saar manufacture, rested against the wall, its power cell fully charged and ready for use. The only evidence of disturbance was a small puddle of viscous, phosphorescent fluid near the relay unit. The substance possessed an unnatural thickness, clinging to itself rather than spreading across the floor as liquid should. When Thade directed his lumen toward it, the fluid emitted a barely audible high-pitched keening sound that set my teeth on edge and caused my augmetic hand to spasm involuntarily. Thade collected a sample in a sealed container, his movements precise and methodical despite the obvious tension in his shoulders. The Dalak information broker seemed unsurprised by Draylock's disappearance, as though it confirmed suspicions he had harbored since accepting this contract. We returned to the others with the troubling news. The Guilder received our report with that same impassive mask, but I noticed a subtle shift in posture, not surprise, but confirmation. Whatever had taken Draylock was something the Guilder had anticipated, perhaps even expected. With communication to the surface now impossible and our team reduced by one, we continued our descent. The spiral pathway eventually opened into a vast chamber that defied the architectural logic of the hive. The space stretched beyond the reach of our strongest lumens, its ceiling lost in darkness above and its floor descending in tiered levels below. The chamber should have intersected with known hive structures according to our maps, yet it existed in apparent isolation, as though occupying a pocket of space that followed different physical laws. The tiered surfaces teemed with life, if such a term could be applied to the grotesque forms that moved across them. Corpse rats scurried in packs, their bodies distorted by mutations that had fused multiple specimens together into chimeric abominations. Six-legged creatures with too many eyes flowed like liquid across vertical surfaces. Hive roaches the size of my forearm moved with disturbing coordination, forming patterns that suggested communication or shared purpose. Most disturbing were the hybrid forms, creatures that appeared to be amalgamations of different species melded together through some unknown process. A mass of writhing tissue near our position contained recognizable elements of at least three distinct underhive fauna, their formerly separate bodies now sharing organs and limbs in impossible configurations. The creature pulsed with the same phosphorescence as the fluid we had found near Draylock's equipment. Vex collected samples with professional detachment, though I noticed her hands trembling slightly as she sealed the specimens in containment vials. Her toxin sense, the heightened awareness of biochemical threats common to experienced Escher operatives, clearly registered something profoundly wrong with these life forms. We proceeded cautiously along a pathway that descended through the tiered levels. The altered fauna showed no immediate aggression, but their movements tracked our progress with unsettling precision. The corpse rat chimeras paralleled our course, maintaining exact distance from our group regardless of our pace or direction. The roaches formed perimeters around areas we approached, their antennae vibrating in synchronized patterns. The guilder led us toward a structure at the chamber's lowest level, a geometrically complex formation that resembled a temple or research facility constructed from the same ossified material as the tunnels. As we approached, the hybrid fauna became more numerous and more grotesquely altered. Specimens near the structure exhibited more extensive mutations, with some bearing appendages that appeared almost technological in nature, metallic protrusions and crystalline growths that pulsed with internal energy. Krell's behavior grew increasingly erratic as we neared the structure. The Cawdor Zealot began scratching at his exposed skin with his combat knife, carving crude Aquila symbols into his flesh. Blood trickled down his arms and neck, but he showed no sign of pain, only desperate determination. He muttered constantly, his words too low to discern clearly but carrying the rhythmic cadence of ritual prayers. When Vex attempted to examine his self-inflicted wounds, Krell recoiled violently, insisting that the Emperor's symbols would protect him from what he called the Unlight. He pointed toward the shadows between tiers, claiming to hear voices emanating from the walls themselves, voices that spoke of transformation and transcendence through union with something ancient and patient. The situation deteriorated rapidly when we reached the structure's entrance. The hybrid fauna suddenly shifted from observation to coordinated aggression. The corpse rat chimeras surged forward in attack formations that displayed tactical intelligence far beyond their natural capabilities. The roaches released clouds of spores that caused our rebreather's filters to clog almost immediately, forcing us to expend precious replacements. We fought with desperate efficiency, our weapons creating a perimeter of death around our position. My lasgun cut swathes through the advancing creatures, their bodies rupturing with that same phosphorescent fluid we had found near Draylock's equipment. Vex deployed specialized toxin grenades that created barriers of caustic vapor, temporarily halting the smaller specimens, but proving ineffective against the larger hybrid forms. They demonstrated combat skills that exceeded my expectations for an information broker, his auto pistol delivering precisely placed shots that targeted what appeared to be central nervous clusters in the chimeric abominations. Each successful hit caused the creatures to collapse into uncoordinated masses of twitching tissue, suggesting they operated under some form of shared consciousness or external control. Krell's flamer proved most effective, the promethium streams igniting the hybrid fauna and revealing a crucial weakness. The phosphorescent fluid was highly combustible, causing chain reactions that spread through closely packed groups. The Cawdor Zealot advanced with reckless courage, pushing back the tide of mutated life forms with walls of purifying flame. In the midst of battle, Krell's religious fervor reached its breaking point. The Redemptionist ceased his advance, turning to face us with an expression of terrible clarity. He shouted something about seeing the truth behind the veil, about the necessity of cleansing fire to reveal what hid in plain sight. Before any of us could react, he activated a makeshift Promethean bomb fashioned from spare fuel canisters and a detonator of Cawdor manufacture. The explosion momentarily illuminated the entire chamber, the flash of light revealing what our lumens had failed to detect, countless translucent, arachnid-like forms clinging to the ceiling above us. The creatures resembled spiders constructed from crystal and vapor, their bodies partially phased out of material reality. The brief illumination showed thousands of them, perhaps tens of thousands, covering every surface of the vast chamber's upper reaches. The explosion also triggered a collapse in the section where we stood, opening a series of tunnels beneath our position. We fell through darkness, separated by debris and structural failure. I landed hard on a lower level, my flak armor absorbing enough impact to prevent serious injury, but leaving me disoriented and temporarily isolated from the others. The tunnels around me pulsed with bioluminescence, providing just enough light to navigate by. I moved cautiously, searching for signs of my companions while remaining alert for threats. The architecture here differed from the upper chambers, more mechanical in nature, with components that resembled technology but functioned like living tissue, pumping fluids through transparent conduits and processing unknown substances in sac-like chambers. I eventually located Vex and Thade, who had managed to stay together during the fall. The Dalak information broker had suffered a leg injury, his movement hampered but not completely restricted. Vex appeared physically unharmed but displayed signs of toxin exposure despite her respirator, her eyes bloodshot and her movements occasionally uncoordinated. Of the Gilder, we found no immediate sign. The robed figure had been near Krell when the explosion occurred, potentially caught in the worst of the blast. Whether this represented a fortunate elimination of a manipulative employer or the loss of our only guide remained unclear. As we regrouped and assessed our situation, the tunnel network around us began to shift. Walls rippled with peristaltic movements, passageways sealed and reopened in different configurations, and the bioluminescence intensified in patterns that suggested purposeful communication. The structure wasn't merely alive, it was responding to our presence with deliberate reconfiguration. We chose a direction based on Thade's inexplicable confidence in navigating the changing labyrinth. The Dalak moved with determination despite his injury, consulting occasionally with a device he kept concealed within his coat, something that resembled a compass but responded to stimuli beyond conventional electromagnetic fields. Our progress through the tunnels became increasingly difficult as the structure's reconfiguration accelerated. Passages that had been open seconds before sealed themselves as we approached. New openings appeared in walls and ceilings, disgorging more of the hybrid fauna that had attacked us above. The creatures seemed less aggressive here, more focused on observation and tracking than direct confrontation. The first indication that we were being hunted came when the bioluminescence behind us intensified, casting elongated shadows that moved independently of any visible source. Thade noticed first, his concealed eyes apparently detecting something through his specialized lenses that remained invisible to normal perception. His pace increased despite his injury, his hand constantly returning to the specialized ammunition in his coat pocket. The pursuit became more obvious as we continued, with disturbances in the air creating rippling distortions that followed our path through the tunnels. These distortions moved through solid matter without resistance, passing through walls and floors as though they were insubstantial. Whatever pursued us existed partially outside conventional physical laws, a fact that explained how Draylock had vanished without disturbing his equipment. We reached a junction where several tunnels converged into a larger chamber filled with pod-like structures. The pods contained partially formed organisms that combined elements of human anatomy with the same crystalline growths we had observed in the hybrid fauna. Some pods held recognizable equipment, pieces of armor, weapons, and technical devices being gradually incorporated into the growing forms. Thaid identified one pod containing fragments of Vansar technology identical to components Draylock had carried. The implication was clear and horrifying. Our missing tech specialist was being processed and transformed within this biological machinery, his physical form and equipment repurposed into something no longer human. The rippling distortions pursuing us converged at the chamber entrance, blocking our primary escape route. The entities began to take more substantial form as they entered the pod chamber, their translucent bodies becoming partially visible in the bioluminescent light. They resembled arachnids constructed from folded space, their limbs extending and retracting through dimensions beyond normal perception. Thaid made a decision that likely saved my life, though it cost him his own. The Dalak information broker pushed me toward a secondary tunnel, instructing Vex to ensure my escape. Before I could protest, he removed a cache of rad grenades from his coat, weapons strictly prohibited in most hive environments due to their long-term contamination effects. The Dalak activated the entire cache, the radiation counters on the devices spinning past their warning thresholds into lethal territory. He used the final moments before detonation to seal the passage behind us, trapping himself with the approaching entities and ensuring the structural collapse would separate us from the immediate threat. The explosion rocked the tunnel network, radiation alarms on my equipment screaming warnings before failing completely. Vex and I continued through the secondary passage, putting as much distance as possible between ourselves and the contamination zone. The Escher toxin specialist administered rad-countering compounds from her supplies, providing temporary protection against the residual radiation that had penetrated the collapsed section. As we moved through the tunnels, I realized with growing horror that Thaid's sacrifice had only delayed the inevitable. The rippling distortions appeared ahead of us, phasing through solid matter with that same impossible fluidity. The entities weren't following our physical path through the tunnels, they were moving through the underlying structure of reality itself, taking shortcuts through dimensions we couldn't perceive. The truth became inescapable, we were not merely being hunted. We were being herded, driven toward some predetermined destination by intelligences that understood the tunnel network as intimately as a spider knows its web. The question was no longer whether we would escape, but what purpose our capture would serve in the incomprehensible designs of whatever dwelled in these ancient depths. The ancient control room materialized before us like a relic from another age. After endless hours of crawling through maintenance ducts slick with centuries of accumulated filth, Vex and I had stumbled upon this chamber by accident, or perhaps by design. The room was a perfect hemisphere, its curved walls lined with cogitator banks that predated the Imperium itself. Strange symbols flickered across screens of unknown material, neither glass nor crystal, but something that seemed to shift between states of matter as data flowed across its surface. The Gilder was already there, waiting. My las gun came up instinctively, power pack humming with readiness. The blank mask turned toward me, reflecting the eerie blue light of the ancient machines. I hadn't seen the Gilder since Krell's explosive sacrifice, yet here he stood, robes unmarked by the violence that had claimed Draylock and Thaid. Vex moved to my flank, her needler trained on the Gilder's chest. Her breathing had grown labored over the past hour, the toxin exposure progressing despite her respirator's filters. Blood vessels had burst in her eyes, creating a web of crimson across yellowing sclera. Her hands trembled slightly, a deadly tell for someone whose profession demanded surgical precision. The Gilder raised gloved hands in a placating gesture, then reached for the featureless mask. I tensed, finger tightening on the trigger, uncertain what face I might find beneath. The mask came away with a soft pneumatic hiss, revealing features that belonged to no mere Gilder. The face was gaunt and weathered, bearing the distinctive scars of one who had survived warp travel without proper Geller field protection. A small silver aquila hung from a chain around his neck, but it was the signet ring on his left hand that revealed his true identity, the stylized Eye of the Imperial Inquisition. My weapon lowered slightly, decades of conditioned respect for the Emperor's most feared servants overriding immediate survival instincts. The man who had posed as a Gilder explained his presence with clinical detachment. He was Interrogator Clave, agent of the Ordo Xenos, dispatched to investigate anomalous activity in Necromunda's deepest reaches. The contract, the expedition, the careful selection of our team, all had been orchestrated to provide cover for his true mission. The Inquisition had tracked a pattern of disappearances and temporal anomalies to this region of the Underhive. Their analysis suggested a non-human intelligence at work, specifically, a Rudd infestation of unprecedented scale. But these weren't ordinary Rudd. Clave's data indicated this colony had evolved in isolation for millennia, exposed to the unique environmental conditions of Necromunda's toxic sump waste and trace warp contamination from ancient reactor breaches. The creatures pursuing us were Rudd, but changed by their environment into something the Ordo Xenos barely recognized. Their natural entropic field had evolved, becoming more selective and controlled. They could accelerate the aging process in targeted materials while leaving others untouched, explaining how Draylock's equipment remained pristine while the tech priest himself had vanished. As Clave spoke, I noticed changes occurring in the chamber around us. The metal floor beneath our feet had begun to discolor, patches of rust spreading outward from where we stood. The effect wasn't uniform, some sections aged rapidly while adjacent areas remained untouched. The pattern suggested purpose rather than random decay. Vex noticed it too. She staggered backward, watching in horror as her needler's barrel began to oxidize, the metal flaking away beneath her fingers. She dropped the weapon before the degradation could reach the toxin reservoirs, potentially releasing deadly compounds into our confined space. The entropic field was intensifying. Clave moved with sudden urgency toward the central console. His hands flew across the ancient controls with practiced familiarity, suggesting this wasn't his first visit to this chamber. The cogitators responded to his commands, displays shifting from incomprehensible data streams to what appeared to be a three-dimensional map of the surrounding hive sections. The map revealed what we had all suspected but couldn't confirm. The tunnels, chambers, and structures we had traversed existed in a pocket of warped space-time, occupying physical dimensions that shouldn't have been possible within Necromunda's established geography. The control room served as a nexus point, a place where this pocket reality connected with normal space. Clave activated a device built into his wrist, a beacon that would summon an Ordo Xeno strike team to our location. The signal penetrated the warped space-time barriers, broadcasting our coordinates to Imperial forces waiting in orbit. Reinforcements would arrive within hours if we survived that long. The entropic field continued to intensify. My flak armor began to deteriorate, decades of wear occurring in seconds. The synthetic material of my uniform grew brittle, threads unraveling at stress points. Most concerning was the effect on organic matter. My exposed skin began to dry and crack, blood vessels becoming more prominent beneath the surface as they weakened. Vex suffered worse effects. The toxin exposure had already compromised her system, making her more vulnerable to the entropic acceleration. Her respirator mask crumbled away, revealing facial features that aged before my eyes. Skin sagged, then tightened as moisture evaporated. Her hair, once vibrant even in the Underhive's perpetual gloom, turned gray and began to fall away in clumps. Clave directed us toward a recessed alcove near the main console. The space contained what appeared to be stasis technology, not Imperial in design, but something far older. The interrogator explained that the alcove could shield one person from the entropic field, preserving them until the strike team arrived. His tone made it clear this was not an act of mercy, but operational necessity. Someone needed to survive to report directly to the Inquisition. The decision was made for us when the first Rudd materialized within the chamber. Unlike the shadow forms we had glimpsed earlier, this entity appeared fully in our reality, and the sight defied sanity. The creature existed in multiple temporal states simultaneously, its form blurring between developmental stages as it moved. Limbs appeared, aged, and withered within seconds, only to regenerate and begin the cycle anew. Its exoskeleton shifted between translucent newborn chitin and ancient calcified plates, creating a strobing effect that strained human perception. Clave faced the creature with grim determination, drawing a weapon I hadn't seen before, an ornate pistol that hummed with energy containment fields. The weapon discharged with a sound like reality tearing, launching projectiles that phased between states of matter. Where they struck the Rudd, the creature's temporal cycling momentarily synchronized, forcing it into a single state of existence long enough for conventional physics to affect it. More Rudd began to materialize throughout the chamber, emerging from spaces between spaces, their entropic aura intensifying with each new arrival. Vex collapsed beside me, her body unable to withstand the accelerated aging. She pressed something into my hand, a data slate containing her analysis of the samples she had collected. Her final act was one of scientific dedication, preserving information that might help the Imperium understand what we had encountered. Clave continued firing, each shot temporarily stabilizing the Rudd but failing to cause permanent damage. The creatures seemed to learn from each attack, their temporal cycling patterns adapting to minimize vulnerability. They converged on the interrogator with purposeful coordination, their movements suggesting not just animal intelligence but complex strategic thinking. The inquisitorial agent shouted for me to take the stasis alcove, his voice cracking as the entropic field affected his vocal cords. He wouldn't survive long enough for extraction, but the information had to reach the Ordo Xenos. The strike team would need firsthand testimony about what we had witnessed. I moved toward the alcove, clutching Vex's data slate. As I reached the threshold, I glanced back to see Clave surrounded by Rudd entities. The interrogator stood his ground, firing his phase pistol in precise bursts. Then, in a moment that burned itself into my memory, one of the Rudd simply appeared within the space Clave occupied. The effect was immediate and horrifying. The overlapping entropic fields created a cascading reaction. Clave's body aged centuries in seconds, skin drawing tight against bone before crumbling to dust. His equipment followed, metal oxidizing and plastics degrading to base components. Within moments, nothing remained of the inquisitorial agent but a pile of desiccated organic matter and corroded metal fragments. I stumbled into the stasis alcove as the Rudd turned their attention toward me. The ancient technology activated automatically, a field of energy washing over me as time seemed to slow. Through the transparent barrier, I watched the Rudd approach with that same impossible movement, existing in multiple temporal states simultaneously. The stasis field fully engaged just as the first Rudd reached the alcove. The creature pressed against the energy barrier, its form shifting rapidly between developmental stages. Through this temporal flux, I glimpsed something I hadn't seen before, a collective consciousness linking the individual entities. The Rudd weren't separate creatures, but extensions of a single mind, a hive intelligence that existed across multiple points in time simultaneously. This consciousness regarded me with alien curiosity, probing the stasis field with appendages that aged and regenerated continuously. The barrier held, but the creature's attention revealed something far more terrifying than its physical form. In that moment of contact, I perceived fragments of the Rudd's purpose on Necromunda. The collective wasn't simply infesting the Underhive, it was building something. The hybrid fauna, the transformed human remains, the biological machinery, all were components in a vast psychic transmitter being constructed beneath Necromunda's foundations. The transmitter would broadcast not through space but through time, reaching backward to the colony's founding and forward to some distant future point. More disturbing was the realization that the Rudd weren't the architects of this plan but instruments of something else, something that had slumbered beneath Necromunda since before human colonization. The Rudd collective served as a containment mechanism, their entropic field creating a temporal barrier around whatever ancient presence lay dormant in the planet's depths. Our expedition had disrupted this containment, weakening the barriers that had kept the ancient entity in stasis for millennia. The Rudd's aggressive response wasn't predation but desperate preservation, attempting to repair the damage our presence had caused before something far worse awakened. Time passed strangely within the stasis field. I remained conscious but unable to move, watching as the Rudd continued their inscrutable activities throughout the control chamber. They manipulated the ancient technology with practiced familiarity, adjusting systems and rerouting energy flows to purposes I couldn't comprehend. The arrival of the Inquisitorial Strike Force registered as distant tremors through the chamber's structure. The Rudd responded immediately, their collective consciousness shifting focus from the control systems to defensive postures. They phased out of conventional reality, becoming the shadow forms we had glimpsed during our descent. The strike team breached the chamber with overwhelming force. Deathwatch Space Marines in midnight black armor stormed through blasted bulkheads, their specialized weapons discharging targeted electromagnetic pulses designed to force the Rudd into synchronized temporal states. Behind them came tech priests of the Ordo Xenos, their augmetic limbs bearing sensors and containment devices specifically calibrated for non-human entities. The battle unfolded before me like a silent tableau, the stasis field blocking all sound. The Death Watch moved with transhuman efficiency, their tactics clearly developed through previous encounters with Rudd infestations. They established a perimeter around the control console, focusing their efforts on protecting the ancient technology rather than pursuing the retreating Rudd. A tech priest approached my stasis alcove, mechadendrites extending to interface with the control systems. The stasis field fluctuated, then collapsed, releasing me into normal time flow. The sudden transition brought waves of nausea and disorientation as my body adjusted to conventional temporal progression. The Death Watch sergeant approached, his helmet bearing the distinctive skull-faced visor of the Ordo Xenos. His armor showed signs of extensive modification, with additional shielding against entropic effects and chronometric stabilizers built into the power plant. He demanded an immediate report, his augmented voice cutting through the chaos of the ongoing operation. I provided what information I could, my thoughts still fragmented from the stasis experience. The data slate from Vex proved more valuable, its contents already being extracted by waiting tech priests despite the device's strange temporal distortions. The slate appeared centuries old one moment, its casing cracked and power cells depleted, then brand new the next, as though cycling through potential timelines. The strike team secured the chamber with practiced efficiency, establishing a defensible position while tech priests examined the ancient control systems. Their findings confirmed my worst fears. The Rudd Collective had been maintaining a containment system around something deep beneath Necromunda's foundations, something that predated human presence on the planet by eons. The sergeant ordered immediate evacuation, his tone suggesting urgency beyond tactical retreat. The Death Watch had encountered similar situations before, ancient threats better left undisturbed, elder evils that the Imperium lacked the knowledge or resources to properly combat. Better to withdraw, seal the access points, and establish permanent monitoring than risk awakening something that could threaten the entire hive. I was escorted through maintenance ducts and emergency access ways, the path leading steadily upward toward inhabited zones. The Death Watch moved with purpose, ignoring side passages and potential threats in favor of rapid extraction. Thunderhawk gunships waited at designated extraction points, their engines cycling at combat readiness. As we ascended, I noticed changes in the data slate clutched in my hand. The device had stabilized somewhat, but exhibited strange properties, information appearing and disappearing from its display, encryption protocols activating without input, warning messages in languages I didn't recognize scrolling across the screen. The tech priests had copied its contents but permitted me to retain the original, perhaps as evidence or perhaps because they couldn't determine if separating it from me might trigger some unknown failsafe. We reached the surface levels as dawn broke over Necromunda's polluted horizon. The hive's massive structure stretched above us, kilometers of compressed humanity stacked in defiance of engineering logic. From this perspective, the underhive seemed impossibly distant, its horrors contained by countless tons of metal and rockcrete. The inquisitorial agents debriefed me in a secure facility, extracting every detail of our expedition from initial contract to final extraction. They seemed particularly interested in the guilders, claves, actions, and the ancient control room's technology. My description of the Rudd Collective consciousness and its apparent containment purpose drew special attention, with senior agents exchanging glances laden with unspoken significance. When the debriefing concluded, I was presented with options typical of those who encounter inquisitorial operations: mind wipe and relocation, permanent service to the Ordo Xenos, or targeted memory modification and return to previous life. The choice seemed academic. After witnessing what lurked beneath Necromunda's foundations, I could never return to simple underhive contracts. I chose service, though not for reasons of loyalty or duty. The data slate from Vex contained more than her scientific observations. It held encrypted warnings about the ancient presence beneath Necromunda, fragments of information pieced together during our descent. Something slumbered in the darkness, something the Rudd had been containing rather than serving, something that stirred now in its sleep, disturbed by our intrusion. As the sole survivor of our expedition, I carry knowledge no one should possess. The Inquisition believes the threat contained, the access points sealed, the danger neutralized. They don't understand what I glimpsed through the Rud's collective consciousness, a presence that exists outside conventional time, patient beyond human comprehension, stirring from slumber measured in geological epochs. Necromunda continues its eternal cycle of industry and decay, billions of souls going about their lives in ignorance of what lies beneath their feet. The Underhive remains a hunting ground for gangers and scavengers, for ambitious nobles and desperate outcasts. None suspect that the true predator waits far below, stretching after millennia of confinement, reaching tendrils of influence upward through cracks in reality itself. I alone know the truth. I alone remember the faces of those who died to bring this knowledge to light. And I alone understand that what we encountered was merely the guardian, not the prisoner.